This is episode 29 of the Next Year Now podcast.
Hi, I'm Wade Lightheart, entrepreneur, podcaster, and best-selling author. If you've been struggling to live a healthy and happy life and want to find a way to change it, then you need to start listening to the Next Year Now podcast with my friend, Tom Hefner.
One of the great things about nutrition is you're one meal away. Like, you're literally one meal away from making a good decision, from optimizing your biochemistry through the food that you're eating. Like, it's just, it's one meal. Like, your next meal, you make a good choice and you're on the right track.
Welcome to the Next Year Now podcast with Tom Hefner. Tom believes that if you really want to thrive at work and in life, then every day purposeful habits and practices are vital. The Next Year Now podcast will not only help you identify and integrate these habits into your daily life, but also bring you key insights and lessons from some of the most successful people in their fields. And here is your host, Tom Hefner.
Hello and welcome to the podcast devoted to helping you thrive at work and in life. The topic of habits and practices is always front and center in our discussion. But we also explore how we use these habits and practices to improve our personal development, productivity, creativity, health and well-being, business, and entrepreneurship. Today, we speak with Dr. Mike Russell, nutrition expert, best-selling author, and Men's Health magazine columnist. Whether you want to learn to eat right and lose weight, or maybe get that shredded body you've always wanted, Dr. Mike is your go-to resource with three books, a monthly column in Men's Health, and just an all-around good dude. In our conversation, Dr. Mike and I will be discussing the immediate and downstream benefits of adopting a healthy diet, the most effective habits and practices you can adopt today to cultivate a healthy diet and life. And these are going to be drawn from his work and his time as a nutrition consultant and working with pharmaceuticals and organizations. What to do about organic food, hint, it's not what you think it is, book recommendations to fuel your body and your mind, and so much more. We talk a lot about how to thrive in life on this show. It's why the show exists. We cover all kinds of the personal development habits, leadership practices, self-improvement tips, and so on. But one of the most important areas of our life is nutrition. What we eat, when we eat, how we eat, that's literally the fuel for our body. It can have a huge impact on our ability to think critically, to make good decisions, to perform at our peak. So if we really want to thrive in life, then we'd better get serious about our nutrition. That's why today is so important. Today we'll be speaking with Dr. Mike Russell. Mike is a nutrition expert with a focus on translating complex nutritional concepts into practical nutritional habits we can all adopt. And that should be music to all of our ears right about now. Mike holds a degree in biochemistry from Hobart College and a doctorate in nutrition from Penn State University. He's been published in the premier clinical journal in the world, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and he's also consulted with a broad range of food companies, pharmaceuticals, medical schools, professional athletes, and individual clients. You probably know him best from his monthly column in Men's Health magazine, Ask the Nutrition Know-It-All. And if you haven't read his column yet, then check it out alongside his three books, The MetaShred Diet, The Six Pillars of Nutrition, and Dr. Mike's Ultimate Book of Smoothies. Mike, thank you for joining us today, and welcome to the show, my friend.
Thanks so much for having me.
We have a ton to cover today about the best habits and practices of good nutrition. That's why we're here. But before we do that, let's get to know Dr. Mike a little more. Mike, I interview world-class performers and experts, and I'm always fascinated by the paths they've taken to get here. Has nutrition always played a major role in your life, or was there some inflection point that led you to pursue this career?
So I would say nutrition's probably played a major role in my life ever since I was 16 or 17 years old. When I was in high school, I was an athlete. And so I was kind of always, you know, just interested in sports and exercise. But I tore my ACL and blew out my knee playing lacrosse. And I remember going to surgery the next day. And so I was having kind of like my last meal before I had to start fasting for surgery. And I was in a supermarket. I can remember very vividly in Sudbury, Massachusetts. I was at the checkout and I saw like a Muscle and Fitness. And I thought, well, I'm going to be like laid up for a while. Like I'll get one of these because I'd kind of started getting into weightlifting and thought that's what you do when you're a kid and you're into weightlifting. You read Muscle and Fitness. And I probably read it, I don't know, 10 times cover to cover. And that was really kind of the first time I started thinking about nutrition. Like there are articles about, you know, optimizing your protein intake and the role of nutrition for, you know, it was for bodybuilders, but it was basically kind of how nutrition played a role in developing your, you know, your physical presence. And that sort of really kind of got me started down the road on nutrition. And then from there, you know, I pursued some independent studies when I was in high school in nutrition, and I was always very interested in science. And then when I was in college, I had a great chemistry professor named David Craig, who I believe is actually still teaching at Hobart College. And he taught us biochemistry through the lens of nutrition. So he was just like a really cool guy. He is a really cool guy. He would go on a ketogenic diet when we would, during the lessons on fatty acid metabolism and the TCA cycle and gluconeogenesis. So while we're learning to like literally write out all the carbons and hydrogens that would make up the molecules that go through beta oxidation, like he was there with ketone sticks showing, you know, the rise in ketones in his blood due to the manipulations that he was doing with his diet. And that really, you know, was a really important point for me, because it really had this connection between science and nutrition and the power that we have beyond just calories, you know, beyond just the calories that the food provides, but the actual power we have to impact hormones and processes in our body. And then, you know, I went to medical school and I got more biochemistry. I've done a lot of biochemistry in my life. And, you know, from there, I just realized it was one of those things where like medicine was just like, I put my head down. And I was like, I always wanted to be a physician. And when I was in college, and so I went right to medical school after I graduated. And when I was there, it wasn't exactly what I wanted. I think it's just that we picture things in our heads how we think they're going to be, and then we show up and you're like, well, this is actually different. which is, you know, it's part of life, I guess. Yep. I felt like it just wasn't a good match for me. And, you know, in my career path that I've chosen, it's been very entrepreneurial, and I joke that I'm very unemployable. And to be a physician, you have to be very employable, because there are lots of hierarchies and paths that you must take. And so I think personality wise, it wasn't a great match, but I was really more interested in nutrition, in how do we use diet and foods to impact people's behaviors, and then how do we impact behaviors to make better food decisions. So I ended up leaving medical school and going and pursuing my PhD in nutrition instead.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's interesting because having gone to, you know, we've all go to doctors over the years and things like that. I think, and having friends that are MDs, the one thing that's interesting is that a lot of them don't have that kind of good operational knowledge of how biochemistry works with, you know, the foods that you eat and the things that you, I mean, they obviously have very good skills and things like that. But so maybe there's a bridge that you can help build there, between the gulf between what you study and what they practice.
Well, you know, it's funny. Is like I was at the University of Vermont, and at that time, the University of Vermont had probably one of the most forward thinking, they call it like a foundational curriculum. Mm-hmm. So when you go to medical school, it's basically like all school for like a year and a half, and then they kind of let you interact with people, you know. But basically, that was, I got the you know, 7 days of nutrition lectures. Like I got the equivalent of what a physician gets as nutrition education during my time there. So I could say like I gotta have that base. So there is a lot, you know, and I don't know. I think people give physicians kind of a hard time. Like, the human body is complex. They're dealing with a lot of stuff. Like, I don't think that necessarily it's a physician's place to have all the answers for nutrition.
No. And it's there's a lot of nonlinear systems. And so they're trained very well to diagnose. And that in itself can be a very challenging thing.
Yeah, totally.
Well, look, with a PhD from Penn State, I mean, come on, Penn State's awesome, right?
Literally not a better.
Multiple papers published in premier journals. Like, why didn't you pursue a career in academia outside? I mean, because one thing I know about academics, having spent a lot of time in that world in graduate school, is that like it is a place for people that maybe don't fit the kind of standard 9-to-5 employable hierarchy.
Yes, partly because I feel like I'm still too unemployable to be an academic. No, but it was just kind of the way I think it. Like science, I don't know. I think everything is hard nowadays, but science is a tough world to make your living as a research scientist. And, you know, when I was leaving school, they're basically like, a nutrition PhD does like one of two things. They go to academia, right? Or they go to food industry. And I wasn't necessarily really interested in food industry. And then, you know, with academia, it was kind of, do I go on to have, you know, continue to get a postdoc and which is essentially kind of like an upgraded graduate student for another 2 or 4 years to work and kind of develop that? Or do I go become a professor, you know, not at like a tier one research institute like Penn State, but something else, and to kind of build my resume that way? And the thing that I love the most is kind of the discovery and the figuring out of problems. I was able to find that through a different vehicle, through kind of the entrepreneurial and consulting ventures that I was working on. And at that point, my wife and I, we had 3 kids. Being a postdoc doesn't pay very much.
Nope.
You know, also, it was like a little selfish. Like, I was almost 30 and had been in school like my whole life. And we kind of wanted to make a decision of where we wanted to live ourselves. You know, like, we wanted to decide where we wanted to live, not where, you know, chase wherever we could get, wherever I could get the postdoc position. So I kind of say it wasn't necessarily one particular thing that pushed me not into academics. I will say that I have my long-term vision or goal for my career is to go back to academics at one point, and to be a professor. I think that, I really, you know, what my advisor told me, I remember when I was applying to graduate school, you know, she said that, you know, the one thing that separates, you know, getting your PhD from maybe your master's degree or other kinds of academic, you know, achievements is that when you're a PhD, like, you want to discover new things, like, you want to figure out things and ask questions that we don't have answers to. And you want to have that drive to go figure out what are those answers. And so I love that. So I would love to go back into academics to be able to do that.
Well, there's always time for it, man. So you'll get there.
There's always time. Yeah.
Let's talk about good nutrition. I think at a high level, you know, we all know it's important, right? I mean, if we eat healthy, balanced nutritional meals every day, we'll be healthier. But what does that really mean? Mike, break it down for us. What are the benefits and why do we need to stop eating, you know, for lack of a better word, crappy food and adopt a healthy diet today?
The reason why eating healthy today is so important is because I was just actually talking with a friend of mine about this, is there are both short-term and long-term repercussions to how you treat your body. And so, you know, currently, and maybe not currently, probably for a long time, people and humans are obsessed with kind of the short-term thing, you know, like the immediate transformation, the 4-week weight loss. I just wrote a book about a 4-week weight loss plan. So, you know, I can say I'm totally, you know, I know exactly who I'm talking to and what I'm talking about. But, you know, it kind of looking for this, there's this immediate result of why people initially want to change. But what I think we don't appreciate is there these longer term effects. You know, there is something to be said for consistency. Like in finance, it's like the magic of compounding interest, right? Mm-hmm. There's compounding interest in your health that I would say we as a society don't appreciate. Because we're always looking, because people are always looking for that short-term fix, the quick weight loss, and you know, like you need to start now eating healthy and taking care of your body at whatever age, because you need to take advantage of that, the compounding interest of good health. You know, like if you're eating lots of foods with added sugars and you're letting high blood sugar just kind of run rampant throughout your body, you know, there's a repercussion for that that's going to catch up to you when you're 50. Right. If you're 35 years old and you're doing this and you're fit and you're thinking like, oh, I'm good. My cholesterol's good. My blood sugar's good. But it's not. You know, it's not great, right? And when you're 50 years old, you're going to be like, oh, man, like you can't.
This sucks.
like you can't put yourself in a position like my cousin said this, like you can't put yourself in a – you don't want to be 50 and putting yourself in a position where you're playing catch up with your health because you can't really play catch up with your health. And, you know, one of the areas where I'm doing a lot more work now is in brain health and neuron function. And, you know, one of the things about that is that aging is a truism. Like it's happening. There are – very few instances where you can actually reverse the aging process. The best we can do is slow it down. And all these decisions that you want to make every day to eat healthy are helping slow down that process. And so you can start slowing down that process now, or you can start slowing down that process in 20 years, right? But if you spend 20 years accelerating the process and then you're like, wait, I want to slow this down. Like, you're in a much worse position. So just kind of to wrap this up, I think one of the great things about nutrition is you're one meal away. Like you're literally one meal away from making a good decision, from optimizing your biochemistry through the food that you're eating. Like it's one meal. Like your next meal, you make a good choice and you're on the right track.
Well, so let's pull the thread on that a little bit more. I mean, like you said, we're just one meal away. Why is it then that we have such a hard time eating healthy? Because we look around the country and we have a lot of unhealthy, obese, overweight people.
Well, I think part of it is it's a couple different things. One, I think, has to do with hunger and kind of how we deal with hunger, in that your body, you can feel hungry for a variety of reasons. And researchers generally put these into two different categories. They call it physiological hunger, which is your body is telling you you're hungry because you literally don't have enough energy. And so it needs energy. And then there's hedonic hunger, or reward-driven eating. And this would basically be everything else. So tired, stressed, you just saw a commercial that had pizza, you just walked by a restaurant that smelled really good. And so these are kind of all these other reasons. It's noon, right? You're supposed to eat lunch at noon, like, you know, time-based cues. And, you know, so those are two very, between physiologic and hedonic reward-driven eating, like, they're very different. The root cause, the root behind those things are very different, but your body can't tell the difference. Like, you just feel hungry. And so we live, we live in a society where you're getting, there are signals to promote that reward or hedonic-driven hunger constantly. And so that's, you know, that's part of it. And the other part is we eat out more and more now. And it has become, the food industry has made it, and I'm not like one of those kind of like anti-food industry people. So I just said the food industry, I'm like, I don't want to sound crazy. You know, I think the way that the kind of foods and restaurants have been franchised, and less food is actually cooked at a restaurant, that it's decoupled your ability to see a food and approximate how many calories are in it. You know, like, because you would never make a salad at home that's 1500 calories.
Right.
But you could easily go to a restaurant, you look at a salad, you're like, I'm going to get the salad. It looks pretty good. Like, it's got some nuts and cheese, but it, you know, it'll be fine. And it has 1500 calories. And so even, you know, when you're trying to make the right choice, you're like not even close. And so I think that's another, you know, that's another piece that is, you know, that's become very difficult for people. So even when you're trying to navigate the right choices, it's hard to. And then we can't tell the difference between, you know, what's driving our hunger.
I was just in Charlotte and experienced this, where I thought I was doing a good job. I was like, oh, I'm going to get the wood-fired Brussels sprouts, or I don't know if they call them wood-fired, but they're the Brussels sprouts of some sort. And I'm like, Mike, I'm going to tell you, they were the best Brussels sprouts I've ever had in my life. And yeah. I went back there again the next day, and I asked the guy, I said, after I ordered it again for the second time, I said, how do you guys cook these things anyways? I mean, they're really good. He said, I don't know. Let me check. And then he comes back. He's like, oh yeah, well, we deep fry them, and then we do, you know, we add some, you know, this, this, and this. And I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that's why it tastes so good, right? Like, it was not a great option after that, after I realized that.
No, it's totally true. Cause you're sitting there thinking like, I'm getting the roasted Brussels sprouts. Like, this is the thing, you know, this is the thing to do. And, you know, also it's like good food tastes good, right? Good food tastes good for a reason. You know, if you look at something like broccoli or Brussels sprouts, one of the reasons why that is so good for us is, you know, it has to do with it's low in carbohydrates, high in fiber, but it's high in nutrients. Like, it's high in antioxidants that help, you know, promote healthfulness and help fight, you know, DNA oxidation, things like that. But it has all those things as a protective mechanism, right? So that other in the wild, that plants and different things don't eat them, right? So it can survive in right. These cold, rugged environments. It can survive attacks from other things, like, you know, Brussels sprouts or broccoli are robust, you know, foods. And the foods that are really good for you are those kind of robustly grown foods. And so, you know, that's the other thing. Like, they just don't taste as good as the things that are delicious.
Yeah. Well, look, one thing I struggle with, and heck, something we all struggle with, is the deluge of information out there. You know, there's no shortage of diets, fads, and crazes to follow. It's really, really overwhelming. And one of my professors when I was in grad school, Dr. Barry Schwartz, he's a psychologist from Swarthmore, describes it as the paradox of choice. You know, we have so much choice now that it can paralyze us. So then oftentimes we just avoid making any decision at all. So if we want to change our nutrition, if we want to start eating better, what are some simple tips to help us get moving towards healthier eating, Mike?
So I think that, you know, you're right on with that, that we kind of can get overwhelmed with choice and thus make no choice, right? Or whatever the, you know, the thing is in front of us that we are reflexive to eating. And one of the things that I always work with clients to do, I've mentioned the Metastra diet a couple times, and it's foundational in that, is you set up your diet plan so you're making as few choices as possible. Because, you know, as your day goes on, because I always think, you know, with every choice you have to make, right, there's a chance of error. And then when you layer onto that, like, well, you're like, what are factors in your life that will increase that error margin, right?
fatigue, stress, distraction, right? Or what's just known as like Monday, you know? Like, and so what I like to do with clients is we remove as much choice as possible. Try to get your nutrition to run on autopilot so that you don't deal with, you're not kind of having to navigate those varying margins of error throughout the day. And you just can focus more on execution and more on just executing, because when you do that, you have a much higher likelihood of success. But, and so that's why, and this is another thing I think with all the information that people have, is it seems like nutrition should be more complicated than it is. And, you know, nutrition can be very complicated. And I have clients where I had, you know, private chefs that were weighing and measuring every food that they cooked for their person for 4 to 5 years.
Wow.
Nonstop. Right. But, you know, that would be someone who is a lot of resources, is very, you know, considers nutrition to be essential and has a very high stakes to their performance, whether it be like mental or physical, like millions of dollar high stakes. And so they're willing to go through that, you know, that level of detail and rigor and discipline to do that. But you don't have to do that to get great results. Like there's a huge spectrum. And what I always recommend people do is the only way to make change is change from your current situation to a little bit closer to where you want to go. Whereas people generally ignore their starting point, just see the ideal and just start at ideal. So the best way that you can start making simple changes with your diet is just kind of figure out where are you doing with your diet currently. And most people that I find are doing what I call nutrition freestyling, which is essentially you're just kind of eating whatever food is in front of you, whenever you want, whenever you feel like eating.
Guilty.
You know, you don't have necessarily a regimen or a plan, or, you know, you're trying to make good choices, but it's all over the place. And so the first thing that you do there is let's just try to get a little bit more control over what you're doing and what you're eating. And, you know, with that control is going to come success, and then it kind of snowballs from there. So a great place to start is breakfast, because there's really good data on specifically protein intake at breakfast, that if you can get adequate protein at breakfast, it has impacts on your brain's ability, on your brain's kind of ability to crave foods later on. It has impacts on your blood sugar later in the day. It helps maximize, you know, the muscle building signals to your body early in the day when you're generally not getting them. So breakfast is kind of like a big key area. And it's generally for people a simpler, less hectic time of the day. Like, I mean, I have 4 kids, and so the mornings are hectic, but you know, there's planning that can happen in the evening. I get up before them, so there's planning that can happen. That, you know, like you have time at breakfast to maneuver, right, in a consistent way, where sometimes at lunch or at dinner, it's so much more variable. So you start with breakfast and you say, like, how do I get, you know, some protein, fruits or vegetables at breakfast? And start very simple like that. And then you kind of expand that to lunch and you expand that to dinner. When you can do that consistently, you're like, wow, it makes such an impact. It's difficult because you're hearing like all these new things, like I need to do this, like food for my genes and probiotics and all this other stuff. And you're like, how could just eating protein and vegetables at every meal and then starch or grain-based carbohydrates around activity, how could that be the solution? You know, it's not the ultimate solution, but it's going to get you 80% of the way there. Hmm. And then you can start tweaking and adjusting. So I recommend to get started, start with breakfast, because research shows generally people eat small amounts of protein at breakfast. Figure out how you can get about 30 grams protein at breakfast. And to do that, usually kind of stack it from a bunch of other foods. Mm-hmm. Like for me, I'll have oatmeal, eggs, a glass of kefir, and then usually some sort of like some chia seeds or something like that. And then some fruit, some berries. And when I put all that together, that's going to get me about 30 grams of protein. And I basically eat the same breakfast every day for a month. And I change it up like once a month, because the repetition, it breeds consistency, and, you know, it helps you kind of set the stage for making good food choices later in the day as well.
Well, and it goes back to that point you said about taking out choice, right? There's a certain amount of decision fatigue. I remember Barack Obama talking about people asking about, you know, his dad jeans that he used to wear. He said, look, like, I wear the same outfit, you know, maybe plus or minus one outfits because I don't have to think about it. It's just I get up, I put it on. And as silly as that seems, that frees up your cognitive resources for, in his case, obviously, for the bigger decisions.
Yes. No, totally. I think that willpower is a really interesting topic, because it's like, it is like that. Like, I do believe you need to try to conserve it, right? But at the same time, you can push it. And if you keep asking, it's always going to be there. Like, if you don't want to give up, it's always going to be there. But I think the thing with food and willpower, at some point, you are going to get worn down where it just loses its level of importance to you. You know, it's not that you ran out of willpower. It's just the thing that you're using your willpower to fight against, like the giant soft pretzel with cheese sauce, is, you know, like all of a sudden it's just not important. Like, you look at, you're like, you know, stressed, tired, hungry. Then you're like, this delicious food.
I mean it.
Yeah. So it's not that your willpower gave out, but you just make it, you just reprioritize your level, you know, what's important. Yeah. But, the decision fatigue is a different, is another layer on why, I like to, you know, automate nutrition or kind of cut down on those, you know, pre-plan, because it just, what I've seen through the years of consulting and helping people is that when they, nutrition doesn't make it very high on the hierarchy of importance, you know, like work is going to get there higher, family commitments are going to become higher, and it's hard to get people to move nutrition up that hierarchy where they're going to start saying, no, I'm going to, you know, find the time to make this healthy meal over making sure my kids get to soccer. Like, it just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So don't put yourself in a position where you need to make those decisions.
Mike, one thing you hear a lot, I'm sure I hear it a lot in food discussions, healthy food discussions, is the importance of organic food. And so I've heard a lot of arguments one way or the other, but is organic food really better and why?
I gotta tell you, I don't think it's that much better. I think fruits and vegetables are very important. For me, things like buying organic fruits and vegetables, that's kind of like another, a little bit, a decision that's a little bit higher up, kind of in the hierarchy of food decisions. Like, that you need to worry about getting all your fruits and vegetables. And once you do that, if you want to start choosing organic or non-organic, then you can do, you know, then that's like a choice that you can make. But the, you know, the nutrient quality, generally not that much better. You know, it is with certain foods, like organic strawberries have been shown in one, maybe two research studies to have higher levels of vitamin C. You can make the argument that, you know, you're not really short on vitamin C if you're eating fruits and vegetables at every meal. So I think the nutrient differences are nominal. A lot of places, like, where, you know, kind of, I live in Western New York, we have access to farmers markets. Those farmers aren't necessarily all organic. You know, they're growing kind of on small scale, and, you know, they're rotating their crops more kind of as a means of surviving and producing quality foods. So while they're not organic, like, I think those are also very nutrient rich and quality foods. For me at this point, and the other thing, I think organic is becoming big business. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if one of the reasons why people made a move towards organic produce was to get to smaller farming, right? Because they felt like that was important. Organic farming is becoming, you know, larger scale farming. And so if that was kind of the reason why it became popular in the first place, it kind of, like, I don't know, it kind of skirts the main hypothesis in the first place. But so, you know, to be honest, as much as organic is talked about, I don't actually think about it that much.
What about so some people will talk about the kind of the biophysiological effects of pesticides, right? And so I just read an article where I forget the organization that does that comes out with the Dirty Dozen every year. But they talk about the amount of pesticides on, say, like strawberries and spinach, when they've done, you know, various studies and kind of inspections, and say, okay, like, spinach has just an insane amount, strawberries have an insane amount. And maybe it's because they're more prone to having pests than others, say, like avocado, which has a thick, you know, skin to kind of protect itself. Are those pesticides having, you know, an outsized negative effect on, you know, from a biophysical response?
You know, so I would say, I don't think we have an answer, but this is how I think about it. And just because you mentioned strawberries. So with, like, those soft flesh fruits, you know, those are generally the ones that have the higher levels of pesticides. So something like an avocado, like, not eating like the avocado skin anyway.
Right.
And so I would say actually strawberries are the only thing that we generally buy organic. Excuse me, in my house, probably just because my kids literally eat them every single day. except, like, for whatever reason, like, March and April, they're like, is the most expensive time in the world for organic strawberries. So we generally take a break. But, yeah, you know, I think one of the things, and I look at nutrition through this lens as well, is that what is the impact of these pesticides, you know, let's say consuming these pesticides in the grand scheme of your diet, right? And is that the rate limiting step in, you know, in your health, right? Mm-hmm. So if you are eating kind of all organic food to avoid all these pesticides, yet you live in New York City and are breathing in the air with the pollution, right? Which one is worse? And, you know, or if you are, you know, making a decision, you know, to not live in a polluted area, so you don't breathe in that air, but you sleep for 4 hours a day, right? Like, which one is worse? Mm-hmm. Like, I would say the lack of sleep is definitely worse.
Yeah.
But so, you know, oftentimes we kind of lose perspective on health decisions and hyper-focus on one area and one aspect and totally neglect something else, which is actually having a bigger impact. And so with weight loss, I call this the rate limiting step of weight loss. And rate limiting step is a reference to chemistry in with a chemical reaction. The reaction is only as fast as its slowest enzyme, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a if you're running in a team and doing like a team event, like you're only as good and as quick as your slowest person.
Right.
And we generally don't look at our health that way. You know, we would become hyper focused on I can only buy organic fruits and vegetables, but you know, and then make all these other horrible health decisions.
Horrible health decisions. Right? I'm going to have a couple beers every night.
Well, that's what I mean. You know, like if you're having like three drinks a day, like who cares? Like you can. Right. So I think that's, you know, instead of the question, like, you know, is organic good or bad or not? Or I think it's more like what's the impact in your overall health? And, you know, based on kind of all the other decisions that you're making. And then, you know, should you or, you know, can you make that decision, you know, because organic is just more expensive. And it so
is. And oftentimes very expensive.
Yeah. So, you know, then and so how does that play? Because, you know, I think there's this great the movie Supersize Me, which and now came out like forever ago. There's this one scene that I'll never forget. I probably saw the movie like 10 years ago where there's a woman went and saw Jared, the subway guy who's now in jail. He was giving a talk. And Morgan Spurlock was interviewing this young girl who and her mother, they're both overweight, outside the school after the talk. And she's crying because she's never going to be able to lose weight because she can't afford to eat at Subway every day. Right. And because she's just identified, you know, she's seen this guy. The only way to lose weight is Subway. And so and thus I can't. So I'm going to have Cheetos instead. And that's the line of thinking that I really push back against with organic foods or with any, you know, with any kind of thing like that, is that if you're going to all of a sudden eat less vegetables or don't think that you can be healthy because you can't afford organic produce, that's a mistake. You know, I once had a conversation with a woman who is an executive at it's not Hy-Vee. It's like there's this giant supermarket chain in Texas and I'm drawing a blank on it. It's going to drive me crazy now. But so she would say, you know, they would have families that would come in into her store that had a $50 a week budget for a family of four. Oof. And I mean, they're not going to buy organic strawberries, right? Nope. But a lot of times I've bought into this, well, I can't, so what am I going to buy? And it's like, you know, canned vegetables are bad, but I don't, they're better than nothing, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's kind of like, how do you move up the chain? So maybe you're buying canned green beans and then you can buy frozen green beans and you can buy fresh ones and then you can buy organic ones if you want. And so I think we need to look at nutrition kind of on that spectrum as well. I think that's, you know, that's really important.
If you've really been struggling with your diet and nutrition, then I want you to stop what you're doing for just a few moments. If you're at the gym, you know, take a minute to rest between those sets. If you're driving to or from work, you might want to turn the volume up here because this next question I have for Dr. Mike is going to be a game changer for you. Mike, thinking back over the years through your experience coaching athletes, celebrities, and just average persons like me, can you share with us some of the most effective habits and practices for good nutrition? I'm talking about the ones that are your go-to and produce the most significant change in your clients' eating habits and choices.
So I would say the first thing I've found for people who exercise in the morning will generally do it fasted because they wake up and just go and work out and can sometimes have trouble reaching the intensities that they need to help achieve, you know, whatever their weight loss goals or what they're trying. Having something before they work out, you know, if you get up and then start working out right away, it's going to need to be something liquid, like a watered down sports drink and maybe a little bit of protein powder, something like that. Getting some simple carbohydrates and some protein in before you exercise in the morning fasted is just a total game changer for so many people.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's just, you know, like sugar is consistently shown to improve performance from a psychological perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, there's data to show that you can just swish and spit out a sports drink and get a similar increase in exercise performance as if you would have drank the sports drink itself. So there's a psychological piece to it. Mm-hmm. But there's also a physiological piece. Some people just don't regulate their blood sugar as well. And when you wake up first thing in the morning and you're fasted, you know, like your blood sugar is going to be a little bit low. And then if all of a sudden you're calling on these resources, for high intensity exercise that demand more glucose, like they just can have trouble mobilizing and supporting those needs. And so having something to eat right before you train, you know, even if it's first thing in the morning is really a game changer for so many people. And, you know, I think it's important that you're able to exercise, you know, fasted, not, you know, just for kind of this idea of metabolic flexibility. Not having fuel, right, is impairing your intensity. Then you really need to make sure you fuel up, because especially if you're looking for weight loss, it's not about how long can you train. It's about how intensely can you train. You know, can you hit, you know, those points in your heart rate? Can you do the reps that you need to do? And having, you know, some carbohydrates and protein before you train is going to help you do that. And a lot of people will shy away from that because they're like, oh, I'm trying to lose weight, so I don't want to eat before I exercise because I'm not going to burn as much fat while I'm exercising. And I would say the purpose of you exercising is not to burn fat during the session. If you're trying to lose weight, the purpose is during your session is to create as much metabolic disruption and overall calorie burn that your then body needs to recover from, which costs a lot of calories down the road. Mm. And so having some fuel prior, you know, is going to help you create that bigger disruption. So that's really important.
What do you say about, because it's a big thing now with intermittent fasting. What are your thoughts there?
It's, I will say intermittent fasting is a tool in the toolbox that I rarely pull out. I just think people generally are more compliant when you let them eat. to be totally honest, I am not convinced the data shows there's an actual advantage to intermittent fasting over a carbohydrate restricted diet. Like there's some data to show you basically get the same effects. So if you could still eat some protein and fats and vegetables, why let's do that instead of not eating at all. So I think that's part of it. I think a lot of people, it's a very stark behavioral change for a lot of people, where what trips most people up with their nutrition is the behavior and the execution. So then all of a sudden, when you put them in an environment where, you know, it's a total different behavior change, then that is very difficult. The other thing is, the way that most people fast is they fast all day and then they eat at the end of the day a large meal. As we were talking about before, you can easily go out to eat and eat a 1500 calorie salad. Like, go and sit down and eat. Like, you could easily eat your day's worth of food.
Yeah, because you're going to be hungry at that point. You're going to be like, I'll eat anything. You put a book in front of me. I'm going to eat it.
and, you know, there's some really interesting data around circadian rhythms, which basically, you know, kind of the cycle in which the sun rises and sets and how that impacts your physiology. That's probably one of the top three things I'm most interested in just on a personal level lately. And, you know, that would be the opposite. Like if you were to eat within your circadian rhythm and in line with actually how your body's blood sugar tolerance changes throughout the day, you would eat your largest meal at the beginning of the day and you eat smaller meals as the day goes on and you don't eat much at night. And so that's totally counter to kind of how people generally intermittent fast. So, I mean, I could honestly tell you, I could think of one client who I've done intermittent fasting with in the last 10 years. It was because we had dieted him down over the course of 6 months to get really lean. And we were to the point where we couldn't really cut calorie, you know, like his meals were already so small, like I couldn't cut a small meal in half even more. Mm-hmm. And so instead, what we were doing on the weekends was he would just not eat. He would skip a meal, you know, and so or fast so that the next meal could be of an adequate size, because research shows that it's less about meal frequency and more about meal size if you're looking to maximize satiety. So, you know, in that one instance, we used it as a tool to allow his meals that he was eating to be of normal size, but he had already been dieting for like 6 months, and this was not like a normal scenario. You know, he was kind of all in on whatever it takes.
Gotcha.
So I rarely never use it.
Okay. Well, look, before I move on to the last part of our interview, is there anything else you want us to know about nutrition? Something that I didn't ask you about, but you'd be like, listen, Tom, this is really important.
No, I mean, I think what is really important that we appreciate about nutrition, and you kind of had referenced this at the beginning, is that it impacts all aspects of your physiology, and that the foods you eat aren't just calories. Like, I was just giving some talks to athletic directors and to some college athletes. And one of the things I was trying to stress to them is like, you know, the foods that you eat, it impacts your hormones. It impacts, you know, how your body functions. It's not about like just getting enough calories to lose weight or put on muscle. Like, that's such a reductionist view that really takes away from the power of nutrition. And, you know, that consistently looking at, you know, how do I get protein at every single meal? Like, how do I get vegetables at every single meal? And just taking a half an hour, you know, if everybody listening to this could just take a half an hour in the next day or so to look at how they normally eat during the day, and then just find one or two ways that they could improve that. You know, I'm not getting protein at breakfast, so what can I do to instead, right? What are protein foods? How do I get them at breakfast? Like, these are easily things that you can research. But putting in that 20 to 30 minutes of kind of prep time on your diet once a week is such a game changer. You know, there was a really interesting study with women and exercise showing, they're looking at how they increase exercise. And they gave some people education and they gave other people journaling. And the journaling was basically negative preparation. Like, when are you not going to exercise? Like, what are those specific situations where your life is going to derail you? What are you going to do instead? And then they had to like kind of journal every couple of days about what they did instead. How could they make the changes? And the women who journaled versus the women who just got education about why exercise is awesome doubled the amount of exercise that they were doing. And so it's like, you know, you should eat healthy. Mm-hmm. So that information is not necessarily going to help you. What's going to help is how can you troubleshoot healthy eating in your life? And that's a very specific thing, you know, to you, because everybody's life is different. So that's really makes the difference.
I like that, because maybe it's the engineer in me, but it's like creating if then statements, right? If this happens, I'll do this. If that happens, I'll do that.
It's totally. I have an article on my website called Nutrition If Then Statements. Yes, it's totally. That's what you need to do.
Vulcan mind meld right there.
How can you create if then statements, you know, for your life? Like, if like lunch at work is a perfect example, right? If the meeting goes over and I forgot my lunch, then what do I do? Like, you should have three restaurants around your office where, you know, I'm just going to get this. Not like, let's wander outside and see what other people are eating, see what I'm feeling like. That's where you get in yourself trouble.
I couldn't put a better bow on that one if I tried. Mike, you're an amazing writer. You've written three highly popular and effective books. And I think behind every great writer, there's a great reader. So I want to segue to probably my favorite part of the show, where I talk about books and reading. And for me, that's probably one of the best habits we can all adopt today. I want you to think about the books you've really enjoyed over the years, or maybe books that have impacted you deeply. What are the two or three books that stand out for you?
So you're right. I love reading. love reading. And if you were to look at where I spend all my money, it's Barnes and Nobles. Like, I just love, I love books. So I think nutritionally, like, one of the first books that really influenced me was The Zone Diet by Barry Sears. And it was kind of back when I was in college and I was trying to figure out like nutrition and stuff and what I wanted to do with it. And he was the first person I felt like in the mainstream that told an interesting story about the connection between biochemistry and nutrition and how it impacted your body. Before him, there was the Atkins diet. Like, if you read the original Atkins book, it's almost like a biochemistry textbook. So, you know, what I think Barry Sears did was he made it a little bit more accessible for people. And so for me, The Zone Diet, you know, was one of the kind of the more influential books. I think some of his ideas, maybe a little, I wouldn't draw the same conclusions, but I wouldn't take away anything from that book and kind of how it influenced me. Another one that I love that I've read, I don't know how many times, is Turning Pro by Stephen Pressfield. And it has nothing to do with nutrition. It's more actually about the saga of the life of a writer and struggling. But I think he writes because he's a writer. and a screenwriter. But what it's about is has this thing called the resistance. And the resistance, like, I gave the book to my wife and she was like, is he in my head? Because it's literally in everyone's head. And it's this thing, this feeling that holds you back from doing the great work that you were meant to be. It's the source of procrastination. And it's an incredible book. It's like the third book in a series. The War of Art was the first one he wrote. It's a quick read. I can't recommend highly enough that people read Turning Pro by Stephen Pressfield. That's a great book. Some others that when I was a kid, when I was in college, I read the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which was like just kind of came out then by Robert Kiyosaki.
Yeah.
And I think that, that really kind of changed the way it was good because it was like a different way to look at life and finance. And I've always, kind of found success in nutrition trying to look at things different ways. And so I think that book is, it was literally kind of flipping traditional personal finance on its head.
Oh yes, and that one. That was one of my. I can't remember when I read it. It's been a while since I've read it, but that was one of my favorite books, just for the very reason that you talked about of flipping conventional wisdom on its head.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I think I read it when I was like 20. So I haven't read it in a long time, but I still have it on my bookshelf because that. And I think one of the things, if you look at kind of the consistency here of the Zone Diet, of Rich Dad Poor Dad, and of Turning Pro is. They all tell a lot of great stories in the book and just kind of on the writing side. That's why I always find that I'm pushing myself to do a better job because it's the stories that people remember, is so important. Another one, that I find myself reading again and again, it's called No Man. This is not like any of those other ones. It's called No Man Is an Island, by Thomas Merton. And Thomas Merton is like, one of the probably, if you could be a famous Trappist monk, Thomas Merton would be the most famous Trappist monk. I don't know which the man wrote a lot of books. And so you can imagine if you dedicated your life to solitude, you'd have a lot of time to write.
Yeah, a lot of time to write. That's right.
But this one, it's just, I don't know, it's really good. Like, it has a lot of insights on human nature and on the importance of discipline and not necessarily things that you would think about when you think of reading the writings of a Trappist monk. But that's called No Man Is an Island. That one is really phenomenal.
Awesome. Those are some fantastic book recommendations. I'm going on to Amazon after this to buy the Turning Pro one.
You will love it. You will love it.
Look, final question. What are you working on now that you're really excited about?
So some of the things I'm working on now, like the last 2 years or so, I've been working on some products that I developed in the area. I'd mentioned I'd become really interested in brain health and brain function. And one is a coffee called Neuro Coffee. That's a coffee. It's a nutritionally enhanced coffee designed to help support brain growth, neuron growth and repair. Mm. And the other one is called Cerevan, which is a blend of these patented antioxidants that help improve focus, attention, and multitasking, kind of working memory, brain function. And so I'm really interested in how we can improve brain function, how we can slow down the brain's aging process, and then how we can use kind of specific antioxidants to drive certain processes in the body that would help, say, like, improve your body's ability to grow and repair neurons, or to, fight oxidative stress in your brain and help improve focus and attention through, not necessarily just kind of the traditional approach of as many stimulants as humanly possible. So that right now I'm kind of the most interested in. And with Neuro Coffee, one of the things that kind of got me down that track of a functional coffee is a lot of what we've been talking about is just kind of behaviors and habits and routines. I've always when I'm trying to help a client, it's like, how can I take what they're currently doing and then just like tweak it a little bit? And with coffee, it's like everybody drinks. If you're a coffee drinker, like, you don't miss your coffee and you never think about, oh man, I got to have my coffee. And so, I just thought, like, what can I do? How can I improve coffee? Like, how can I add something to coffee to make it even better for you? And it took a lot of R&D and I came up with Neuro Coffee.
Awesome. Well, I don't drink coffee, but I know a lot of people that do, so I will definitely share that. Look, this has been a fantastic conversation. One of my passions in life is learning about nutrition, so I really enjoy this conversation. I'm taking a lot of really practical tips and habits away from this, and I know the rest of us are as well. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate you taking the time.
You can connect with Dr. Mike online through his website, mikerussell.com. That's M-I-K-E.
roussell.com, and his Twitter account at Mike Russell. All the links and resources Dr. Mike and I discuss can be found on the page created just for this episode. You'll find it all at nextyearnowpodcast.com/29. Hey, and finally, just a reminder, if you love the show and enjoy learning from our guest each week, please consider giving us a rating and review on iTunes. That really helps us stay relevant and findable by listeners like you. That's it for today. I'll see you next time.